40. That night, the demon didn't sleep. While Piper Greenmantle slept fitfully, dreaming of the upcoming sale and her rise to fame in the magical artifact community, the demon unmade. It unmade the physical trappings of Caveswater, the trees, the creatures, the ferns, the rivers, the stones, but it also unmade the dreamy ideas of the forest. The memories caught in groves, the songs invented only in nighttime, the creeping euphoria that ebbed and flowed around one of the waterfalls. Everything that had been dreamt into this place, it undreamt. The dreamer, it would unmake last. He would fight. They always fought. As the demon unwound and undid, it kept encountering threads of its own story, teased through the underbrush, its origin story. This fertile place, rich with the energy of the ley line, was not just good for growing trees and kings. It was also good for growing demons, if there was enough bad blood spilled on it. There was more than enough bad blood pooled in this forest to make a demon. Little stopped its work. It was the forest's natural enemy, and the one thing that would stop the demon in its tracks had not yet occurred to anyone. Only the oldest of the trees put up a fight, because they were the only things that remembered how. Slowly and methodically, the demon unpicked them from the inside. Black beaded from their decaying branches, they crashed down as their roots rotted to nothing. One tree resisted for longer than the others. She was the oldest and had seen a demon before and knew that sometimes it wasn't about saving yourself. It was about holding out for long enough until someone else could save you. So she held out and stretched for the stars even as her roots were being dug away. And she held out and she sang to other trees even as her trunk was rotting out. And she held out and she dreamt of the sky even as she was unmade. The other trees wailed. If she had been unmade, who could stand? The demon did not sleep. 41. Depending on where you began the story, it was about Gwentlian. She awoke with a scream that morning at dawn. "Get up!" she howled to herself as she leapt from her bed. Her hair hit the slanted attic ceiling, and then her skull did. She pressed her hand to her head. It was still dull gray outside early morning, but she hit switches and scrolled knobs and pulled cords until every light was on in the space. Shadows keeled this way and that. "Get up!" she said again. "Mother! Mother!" Her dream still clung to her, trees melting black and demons hissing unmaking. She waved her hands around her to clear the cobwebs from her hair and ears. She tugged a dress over her head and then pulled on another skirt and her boots and her sweater. She needed her armor. Then she weaved through the cards she had left spread on the floor and the plant she had burned for meditation, and headed directly to the two mirrors that her predecessor had left there in the attic. "Neve. Neve. Lovely Neve." Gwentlian would have known her name, even if the others had not told her, because the mirrors whispered and sang and hissed it all the time. How they loved her and hated her. They judged her and admired her, lifted her up and tore her down. "Neve, Neve, hateful Neve," had wanted the whole world's respect and had done everything to get it. It was Neve, Neve, lovely Neve, who hadn't respected herself in the end. The full-length mirrors were set up to face each other, eternally reflecting a reflection. Neve had performed some complicated ritual to ensure that they were full of all the possibilities she could imagine for herself, and then some, and in the end, one of them had eaten her. Proper witchery, the women of Sigarth would have said. they would have all been shipped off to the woods. Gwynplaine stood between the mirrors. The magic of them tugged and howled. The glass was not meant to show so many times at once. Most people were not built to process so many possibilities at once. Gwynplaine was just another mirror, though, and so the magic glanced off her harmlessly as she pressed her palms to either glass. She reached into all the possibilities and looked around, darting from one false truth to another. "Mother, mother," Gwynplaine said out loud, her disordered thoughts transmuted if she didn't say them out loud at once. And there her mother was, in this real present, this current possibility, this reality where Neve herself was dead, a forest being unmade, and Gwynplaine's mother unmade with them. Unmade. Unmade. Un... With a scream, Gwynplaine smashed the mirrors to the ground. A cry came from downstairs. The house was waking. Screaming again, Gwynplaine cast about her room for a tool, a weapon. There was little in this attic that could make a dent. Ah! She snatched up a lamp, the cord slapping from the wall, and clattered down the stairs. Thump, 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 each foot on the stair double time. Artemis! She cooed, her voice snapping halfway through. She slid into the dim kitchen. It was lit only by the little bulb over the oven and the diffuse gray through the window above the sink. It was only fog, no sun. Artemis! He was awake. Probably he had had the same dream as she. They had the same starry stuff in their veins, after all. His voice came through the door. Go away. Open the door, Artemis, Gwynplaine said. She was out of breath. She was shaking. The forest, unmade. Her mother, unmade. This coward magician hiding in this closet, having killed everyone through his inactivity. She tried the door. He had secured it with something from the inside.
Not today, Artemis said. No, thank you. Too many events this decade. Perhaps later. Cannot do the shock. Thank you for your time.
He had been an advisor to kings. Gwynplaine smashed the lamp against the door. The bulb shattered with a silvery sound. The end of the lamp split the thin laminate of the door. She sang, Little rabbit down the hole, down the hole. Little foxin down the hole, down the hole. Little hound let down the hole, down the hole. Come out, little rabbit. I have questions about demons.
I am a slow-growing creature, Artemis wailed. I cannot adapt so quickly.
If someone is robbing us, come back after business hours,
Calla's voice came from upstairs. Do you know what has happened to my mother? Foul branch! Gwynplaine ripped the lamp free from the door so that she could smash it against the surface once more. The crack widened. I will tell you what I saw in my mirror mirrors.
Go away, Gwynplaine, Artemis said. I can do nothing for any of you. Leave me alone.
You can tell me where my father is, little shrub. What hole did you throw him in? Schwack! The door cleaved in two. Artemis shrank back into the darkness. He was folded over among Tupperware and reusable grocery bags and sacks of flour. He shielded his long face from her as she wielded the lamp. Gwynplaine, Blue said, what are you doing? Doors cost money. Here was Artemis's little daughter. He did not deserve her in any way. Come to rescue him. She had caught hold of Gwynplaine's arm to stop her from cleaving his coward skull with the lamp. Don't you want to riddle him, Blue Lily? Gwynplaine screamed. I'm not the only one who wants answers. Did you hear my mother scream, Artemis? Blue said,
Gwynplaine, come on, it's early, we're sleeping, or we were.
Gwynplaine dropped the lamp, pulled her arm free, and instead snatched Artemis by a hand and his hair. She dragged him from the closet as he whimpered like a dog.
Mom, Blue shouted, her hand cupped over one eye. Artemis sprawled between them, peering up at them.
Tell me how strong this demon is, Artemis, Gwynplaine hissed. Tell me who it is coming for next. Tell me where my father is. Tell me, tell me.
Suddenly he was up and on his feet. He ran for it as Gwynplaine pawed and grasped for him, slipping and sliding on the shattered glass bulb. She went down on one hip hard and clawed her way back up. He was through the sliding glass door to the backyard before she found her footing, and by the time she burst into the foggy backyard, he had already made it up to the first branch of the beech tree.
It won't have you, you coward,
Gwynplaine shouted, although she feared it would. She hurtled after him, beginning to climb herself. She was no stranger to trees and their branches, and she was quicker than him. She snarled,
"You schemer! You dreamer! You—"
Her dress caught on a branch, rescuing him for half a moment. Artemis threw his hands up, found a branch, and clambered up a level. As she began to climb again, leaves clattered urgently and smaller twigs snapped.
"Help!" he said,
only he did not say it like that. He said,
"Oxyreel!"
The word came out rapid and terrified and desperate and hopeless.
"My mother,"
Gwynplaine said, thoughts to words without pause.
"My mother, my mother, my mother!"
The dead leaves of the beech shuddered above them, raining down around both of them. Gwynplaine leapt for him.
"Oxyreel!" he begged again.
"This won't save you. Oxyreel!"
he whispered, and he hung on to the tree. The remaining fall leaves rattled down, branches thrashed, the ground buckled as roots tugged urgently through dirt. Gwynplaine snatched for a handhold, got it, lost it. The branch beneath her shrugged and bucked in a violent wind. The dirt whispered down below as roots heaved. They were too far from the corpse road for this, and Artemis was going to do it anyway. Typical, 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 and then Gwynplaine fell free as the branch twitched below her. She crashed down heavily on her shoulder, all breath escaping her, and looked up to see Blue and her dead friend staring at her. Others stood in the doorway to the house, but Gwynplaine was too dazzled by the fall to identify them.
"What?" Blue exclaimed. "What just happened? Is he—"
"In the tree?" finished Noah.
"My mother
was in a tree and she's dead," Gwynplaine snapped.
"Your father is in a tree and he's a coward. You're the unlucky one. I'll just kill you when you come out, you poisoned branch."
This was in the direction of the tree. Artemis could hear her. She knew his soul curled inside that tree as he was. Damned tree light. Damned magician. It infuriated Gwynplaine to know that he could hide there as long as the beech survived. There was no reason for the demon to be interested in a tree so far outside Caveswater, and so even after everyone else and everything else had died, he would once again emerge unscathed.
Oh, the fury!
Blue looked at the beech tree with her mouth gently agape.
He's in it?
Of course!
Gwynplaine said. She pushed herself up from the ground and took big handfuls of her skirt in her hand so she wouldn't trip on it again.
That's who he is. That's your blood. Didn't you feel roots in your veins?
Curses! Curses!
She stomped back to the house, shoving past Mora and Calla. Gwynplaine, Mora said, what is going on? Gwynplaine paused in the hallway.
Demons coming. Everyone dies, except for her useless father. He'll live forever.
42. On Saturday, Adam woke up to perfect silence. He had forgotten what such a thing was like. Fog moved lightly outside the windows of Declan's bedroom, muting any birds. The farmhouse was too far from a road for the sounds of any cars to reach him. There was no church administration office clunking behind him, no one walking a dog on the sidewalk, no children shrilling onto a school bus. There was only a quiet so deep that it felt like it was pressing on his ears. Then Cabe's water gasped back into existence inside him, and he sat up. If it had come back, it meant it had gone. "Are you there?" He felt his own thoughts, and more of his own thoughts, and then, quietly, barely there, Cabe's water. Something wasn't right. But Adam lingered for a moment after he cast off the covers and stood. Here he was, waking in the Lynch home, wearing last night's clothing that still smelled of smoke from the grill, having overslept the weight class he had this morning by a magnitude of hours. His mouth remembered Ronan Lynch's. What was he doing? Ronan was not something to be played with. He didn't think he was playing. "You're leaving this state," he told himself. But he hadn't felt the fire on his heels for a long time. There was no longer the understood second half of the statement, "and never coming back." He headed downstairs, peering into each room that he passed, but he seemed to be alone. For a brief, trippy moment, he imagined that he was dreaming, walking through this desaturated farmhouse in his sleep. Then his stomach growled and he found the kitchen. He ate two leftover hamburger buns with nothing on them since he couldn't find butter, and then drank the remainder of the milk directly from the carton. He borrowed a jacket from the coat rack and went out. Outside, the fields drifted mist and dew. Autumn leaves stuck to the tops of his boots as he walked down the path between the pastures. He listened for sounds of activity in any of the barns, but on an essential level, he was fine with the silence. This quiet, this absolute quiet, nothing but the low gray sky and Adam's thoughts. He was so still inside. The silence was interrupted as a creature darted up to him. She skittered so quickly and so oddly on her hooves that it wasn't until her hand had slid into his that he realized it was the orphan girl. She held a black, wet stick, and when he looked down at her, he saw that she had bits of bark stuck to her teeth. "Should you eat that?" he asked her. "Where's Ronan?" She pressed her cheek to the back of his hand with affection.
"Savende elintes iferen."
"English or Latin?" he said.
"This way."
But instead of leading him in any particular direction, she released his hand and galloped around him in circles, flapping her arms like a bird. He kept walking, and she kept circling, and overhead, a flying bird checked itself mid-flight. Chainsaw had spotted the movement of the orphan girl, and now she cawed, wheeled, and headed back toward the upper fields. This was where Adam found Ronan, a black smudge in fog-washed field. He had been watching something else, but Chainsaw had alerted him, and so now he turned, hands in the pockets of his dark jacket, and watched Adam approach.
"Parrish," Ronan said. He eyed Adam. He was clearly taking nothing for granted. Adam said, "Lynch?" Orphan girl trotted up between them and poked Ronan with the end of her stick. "You little puke," Ronan told her. "Should she be eating that?" "I don't know. I don't even know if she has internal organs." Adam laughed at that, at the ridiculousness of all of it. "Did you eat?" Ronan asked. "Other than sticks, yeah. I missed weights." "Jesus weeps. You want to carry some hay bales? That'll put hair on your chest. Hey, you poke me with that one more time." This was to the orphan girl. As they scuffled in the grass, Adam closed his eyes and leaned his head back. He could nearly scry, just like this. The quiet and the cold breeze on his throat would take him away, and the dampness of his toes and his shoes and the scent of living creatures would keep him here, within and without. He couldn't tell if he was letting himself idolize this place or Ronan, and he wasn't sure there was a difference. When he opened his eyes, he saw that Ronan was looking at him as he had been looking at him for months. Adam looked back as he had been looking back for months. "I need to dream," Ronan said.
Adam took Orphan Girl's hand. He corrected, We need to dream. 43. 25 minutes away, Gansey was wide awake, and he was in trouble. He didn't know yet what he was in trouble for, and knowing the Gansey family, he might never know. He could feel it, though, sure as he could feel the net of the Glendower story lowering over him. Annoyance in the Gansey household was like a fine vanilla extract. It was used sparingly, rarely on its own, and was generally only identifiable in retrospect. With practice, one could learn to identify the taste of it, but to what end? There's some anger in this scone, don't you think? Oh, yes, I think a little. Helen was pissed at Gansey. That was the upshot. The Gansey family had convened at the schoolhouse, one of the Gansey investment properties. It was a comfortably shabby old stone schoolhouse located in the verdant and remote hills between Washington, D.C. and Henrietta, where it earned its keep as a short-term rental. The rest of the family had stayed the night there. They'd tried to convince Gansey to come spend the night with them, a request he might have fulfilled if not for Ronan, if not for Henry. Maybe that was why Helen was annoyed with him. In any case, surely he had made up for it by bringing interesting friends for them to play with. The Ganseys loved to delight other people. Guests meant more people to display elaborate cooking skills for. But he was still in trouble. Not with his parents. They were delighted to see him. "How tan you are, Dick." And they were, as predicted, even more delighted to see Henry in blue. Henry immediately passed some sort of friend-peer test that Adam and Ronan had always seemed to struggle with, and blue was, well, whatever it was about blue's sharply curious expression that had attracted the youngest Gansey in the first place clearly also caught the older Ganseys. They immediately began to question Blue about her family's profession as they diced eggplant. Blue described an average day at 300 Fox Way with rather less wonder and bewilderment than she'd just used in the car to tell Gansey about the unaverage experience of her father disappearing into a tree. She listed the psychic hotline, the cleansing of houses, the meditation circles, and the laying out of cards. Her perfunctory method of describing it only charmed Gansey's parents more. If she had tried to sell it to them, it would have never worked, but she was just telling them how it was and not asking a thing from them, and they loved it. With Blue there, Gansey was excruciatingly aware of how they almost looked through her eyes. The old Mercedes in the drive, the hemmed pants, even skin, straight teeth, Burberry sunglasses, Hermes scarves. He could even see the schoolhouse through her lens now. In the past, he wouldn't have thought that it looked particularly moneyed. It was sparsely decorated, and he would have assumed that came off as austere. But now that he had spent time with Blue, he could see that the sparseness was exactly what made it look rich. The Ganseys did not need to have a lot of things in the house because every object they did have was exactly the right thing for its purpose. There was not a cheap bookshelf also pressed into service as a repository for extra dishes. There was not a desk that had to carry paperwork as well as sewing materials as well as toys. There were not pots and pans piled on cabinets or toilet plungers sitting in cheap plastic buckets. Instead, even in this crumbling schoolhouse, everything was aesthetic. That was what money did. It put plungers in copper pots and extra dishes behind glass doors and toys into carved hope chests and hung skillets from iron pot racks. He felt quite squirmy about it. Gansey kept trying to catch Blue's and Henry's gazes to see if they were all right, but the trick with trying to be subtle in a room full of Ganseys was that subtlety was a language they all spoke. There was no discreetly asking if rescue was needed. All messages would be intercepted. And so light conversation proceeded until lunch could be removed to the porch out back. Henry and Blue were seated in chairs too far away for him to airdrop aid to them. Helen made a point to sit next to him. He was tasting vanilla by the bucket load.
"Headmaster Child said you were a bit late with your college applications," Mr. Gansey said, as he leaned forward to spoon quinoa onto plates.
Gansey busied himself getting a gnat from his iced tea.
Mrs. Gansey waved her hand at an invisible gnat out of solidarity. It seems like it should be too cold for insects. There must be standing water around here. Gansey carefully wiped the dead insect on the edge of the table.
I'm still in touch with Droman these days, Mr. Gansey said. He's still got his fingers stuck in all the pies in the Harvard History Department, if that's what you're still thinking about.
Jesus, no, Mrs. Gansey said. Yale, surely.
What, like Ehrlich? Mr. Gansey laughed gently at some private joke. Let this be a lesson to us all.
Ehrlich's an outlier, Mrs. Gansey replied. They clinked their glasses together in a mysterious toast. What have you put in already? Helen asked. There was danger in her voice, unidentifiable to non-Ganseys, but enough that their father frowned at her. Gansey blinked up. None, yet.
I can't remember the timing for these things, Mrs. Gansey said. Soon, though, right?
Time got away from me. It was the simplest possible version of theoretically I am to die before it matters, so I used my evenings for other things.
I've read a study on gap years, Henry said.
He smiled at his plate as Mrs. Gansey placed it before him, and in that smile was an understanding that he was fluent in this language of subtlety.
It is supposed to be good for people like us.
What are people like us? Gansey's mother asked in a way that suggested she enjoyed the idea of commonality between them.
Oh, you know, overeducated young people who drive themselves to nervous breakdowns in the worthy pursuit of excellence, Henry said.
Gansey's parents laughed. Blue picked at her napkin. Gansey had been rescued. Blue had been stranded.
Mr. Gansey saw it, though, and he caught the ball before it even hit the ground. I would love to read something from you, Blue, on growing up in a house of psychics. You could go academic or you could go memoir, and either way it would just be fascinating. You have such a distinct voice, even when speaking.
Oh, yes, I noticed that, too. The Henrietta cadence, Mrs. Gansey said warmly. They were excellent team players. Good save, point to the Ganseys, win for team good feeling.
Helen said, I nearly forgot about the bruschetta. It's going to burn. Dick, would you help me carry it in?
Team good feeling was abruptly disbanded. Gansey was about to find out why he was in trouble.
Right, sure, he said. Can I get anyone anything while I'm inside?
Actually, if you'd bring back my schedule by the Ellie furniture, that would be great, thanks, his mother said. I need to call Martina to make sure she's going to be there in enough time.
The Gansey siblings headed inside, where Helen first removed the toast from the oven and then turned to him. She demanded,
Do you remember when I said tell me what kind of dirt I will find on your bro dude friend so that I can spin it before Mom gets out here?
I trust that's a rhetorical question, Gansey said. He garnished bruschetta.
Helen said, You did not get back to me with any information on that front.
I sent you clippings of the Turk Week pranks.
And yet you failed to mention that you had bribed the headmaster.
Gansey stopped garnishing bruschetta.
You really did,
Helen said, reading him effortlessly. Gansey's siblings were tuned to the same radio frequency.
Which one did you do it for? Which friend, the Trailer Park one?
Don't be insulting, Gansey replied crisply. Who told you?
Paperwork told me. You're not 18 yet, you know. How did you even manage to convince Brulio to write that document for you? I thought he was supposed to be Dad's attorney.
This has nothing to do with Dad. I didn't spend his money.
You're 17. What other money do you have?
Gansey looked at her. I take it you only read the first page of the document then.
That's all that would open on my phone, Helen said. Why? What does the second page say? Jesus Christ, you gave Child that warehouse of yours, didn't you?
It sounded so clean when she put it that way. He supposed it was. One Aglimby diploma in exchange for Monmouth Manufacturing. You probably won't be around to miss it, he told himself.
First of all, what has he possibly done to deserve such a thing? Helen demanded. Are you sleeping with him?
Indignation cooled his voice. Because friendship isn't worthy enough?
Dick, I see you stretching to stand on the high ground, but trust me, you're failing. You don't just need a morality ladder to get there. You need a booster chair to put the ladder on. Do you understand what an incredibly bad position this puts Mom in if the stupidity of yours comes to light?
It's not Mom. It's me.
Helen put her head on its side.
Ordinarily, he didn't notice the age difference between them, but just then, she was very obviously a polished adult, and he was a whatever he was.
Do you think the press would care? You're 17. It was the family lawyer, for God's sake. Example of family corruption, etc., etc. I cannot believe you wouldn't at least wait until after the election to do it.
But Gansey didn't know how long he had. He didn't know if he had until after the election. This made his chest feel tight and his breaths go instantly small, so he pushed the thought away from himself as quickly as he could. I didn't think about the ramifications, he said, for the campaign.
Obviously, I don't even know what you were thinking. I was trying all the way out here to put it together, and I just couldn't.
Gansey pushed around a lump of tomato on the cutting board. His heart was still feathered inside him. In a much smaller voice, he said, I didn't want him to throw it all away because his father died. He doesn't want it now, but I wanted him to have it later when he realized he did. Helen said nothing, and he knew that his sister was studying him, reading him again. He just kept pushing that lump of tomato around, thinking about how he really wasn't even sure that Ronan needed the degree after all, and how he regretted making the deal with Child, even as he hadn't been unable to sleep until he did it. He had been wrong about a lot of things, and it was too late now, with time running out, to fix them. It had been a lonesome and guilty secret to keep. To his surprise, Helen hugged him.
Little brother, she whispered, what's wrong with you?
The Ganseys were not huggers, and Helen would not ordinarily risk wrinkling her blouse, and her fine gold bracelets pressed lines into his arm, and something about all of these things combined made Gansey feel dangerously close to tears.
What if I don't find him? Gansey said finally. Glendower.
Helen let out a sigh and released him.
You and that king. When will it end?
When I find him.
What then? What if you do find him?
That's all there is. It wasn't a good answer, and she didn't like it, but she merely narrowed her eyes. She patted some wrinkles out of her blouse.
I'm sorry I ruined Mom's campaign, he said.
You didn't ruin it. I'll just have to, I don't know. I'll find some skeletons in Child's closet to make sure he's compliant. Helen didn't look entirely displeased by the task. She liked organizing facts.
Jesus, to think I thought I'd have to be dealing with hazing and marijuana possession. Who's that girl out there, by the way? You kissed her?
No, Gansey replied truthfully.
You should, she said.
Do you like her?
She's weird, you're weird.
The Gansey siblings smiled at each other.
Let's get this bruschetta out of here, Helen said, so we can get out of this weekend alive.
44. It was a mistake. Adam knew it the moment he fell into the dark mouth of the scrying bowl, but it wasn't like he could leave Ronan there in his dream alone. His physical body sat cross-legged back at the barns, a ceramic dog dish serving as his scrying bowl. Ronan's body curled on the sofa. Orphan girl sat close to Adam, peering into the bowl along with him. That was real. But this was also real. This diseased symphony that was Cabeswater. The forest vomited black around him. Trees melted into black, but in reverse, long black strings of goo dripping up toward the sky. The air shuddered and darted. Adam's mind didn't understand how to process what it was seeing. It was the horror of the black bleeding tree they'd seen before, only it had spread to the entire forest, atmosphere included. If there had been nothing of the true Cabeswater left, it would have been less horrifying, more easily dismissed as a nightmare. But he could still see the forest he had come to know struggling to maintain itself. Cabeswater? There was no answer. He didn't know what happened to him if Cabeswater died.
Ronan! Adam shouted. Are you here?
Maybe Ronan was only sleeping, not dreaming. Maybe he was dreaming somewhere else. Maybe he had arrived here before Adam and had already been killed in his dreams.
Ronan!
Kira!
Moaned the orphan girl. When he looked for her, though, she was nowhere to be seen.
Had she come with him, scrying after him into the bowl? Could Ronan dream another one of her into his dreams? Adam knew the answer to this, yes. He'd watched a dreamt Ronan die in front of the real Ronan. There could be infinite orphan girls here in this forest. Damn it, he didn't know how to call for her. He tried, "Orphan girl!" As soon as he shouted it, he was sorry. Things were what you named them in this place. In any case, there was no reply. He began to move through the forest. He was careful to cling to his body back at the barns, his hands on the cold scrying bowl, his hip bones against the wooden floor, the smell of the fireplace behind him. Remember where you are, Adam. He didn't want to call again for Ronan. He didn't want this nightmare to forge a duplicate. Everything he saw was terrible. Here, a snake dissolving while still alive. Here, a stag in slow motion pedal on the ground, vines growing up through its still living flesh. Here was a creature that was not Adam, but that was nonetheless somehow clothed like him. Adam flinched, but the strange boy was not attending to him. He was instead slowly eating his own hands. Adam shuddered. Cabeswater, where is he? His voice cracked, and Cabeswater heaved, trying to appease its magician. A rock had manifested before him. Or rather, it had always been there in the way of dreams, in the way Noah appeared or disappeared. Adam had seen this boulder before. Its striated surface was covered with purple-black letters in Ronan's handwriting. Adam moved past it as something screamed behind him. Here was Ronan. Finally, finally. Ronan was circling something in the burned-out grass between ruined trees. When Adam drew closer, he saw that it was a carcass. It was hard to tell what it had first looked like. It seemed to have chalky white skin, but deep slashes bit through the flesh. The edges of them curled in on themselves pinkly. A snarl of intestines roped out from under a greasy gray flap and hooked on a red-tipped claw. Mushrooms burst through parts of all of it, and there was something terribly wrong about them. They were difficult to look at. "No," Ronan said. "Oh, no, you bastard." "What is it?" Adam asked. Ronan's hand hovered over two parted beaks, side by side, both rimmed with black and something purple-red that Adam didn't want to consider too deeply. "My night horror. God, shit. Why would it be here?" "I don't know. It cares about what I care about," Ronan said. He peered up at Adam. "Is this a nightmare? Or is this real?" Adam held his gaze. This was where they were now. Nightmares were real. There was no difference between dreams and reality when they stood here in Cabeswater together. "What's doing this?" Ronan asked. "I can't hear the trees. Nothing's talking to me." Adam held his gaze. He didn't want to say, "demon," out loud. Ronan said, "I want to wake up. Can we? I don't want to bring any of it back, and I can't keep my thoughts. I can't." "Yes," Adam interrupted. He couldn't either. "We need to talk to the others. Let's—"
"Kira!"
The orphan girl's thin cry caught Ronan immediately. He craned his neck to see her among the dark branches and pools. "Leave her," Adam said. "She's with us in real life." But Ronan hesitated.
"Kira!"
she wailed again. And this time Adam heard the pain in her voice. It was small and childlike and piteous, and everything in him had been coded to respond to it.
"Kara, Sakara!"
It was impossible to tell if this was the orphan girl they had back at the barns, or if this was a copy, or if it was a monstrous devil bird with her voice. Ronan didn't care. He ran anyway. Adam crashed after him. Everything he passed was hideous. A forest of willows sagged into each other, a bird singing a note backward, a fist of black insects crawling over the stub of a rabbit carcass. The voice did not belong to a monstrous devil bird. It was the orphan girl, or something that looked just like her, and she knelt in a scruff of dry grass. She had not been crying, but she burst into tears when she saw Ronan. As he reached her, out of breath, she held out her arms to him imploringly. Adam did not think she was a copy. She wore his watch with its bite marks on the band, and in any case, this feeble Caveswater lacked the strength to produce such an incorrupt version of her.
"Socorro, socorro,"
she sobbed. "Help, help." The arms she stretched to Ronan were coated and spattered in blood up to the elbow. Ronan skidded to his knees, his arms around her, and it hurt Adam somehow to watch how ferociously he hugged his little strange dream creature and how she buried her face into his shoulder. He stood with her in his arms, holding her tightly, and he heard her saying, "No, you did good. It's going to be okay. We're waking up." Then Adam saw it. He saw it before Ronan did, because Ronan had not yet looked beyond the orphan girl. No, no. The orphan girl had not stopped here because it was all the farther she could run. She had knelt there because that was all the farther she could drag the body. Body was a tender word for it. Long strands of hair stuck to the largest of pieces. All of it was strung out like a string of viscous pearls. This was how orphan girl's arms had gotten painted with blood. This futile rescue effort. "Ronan?" Adam warned as dread welled up in him. At the tone in Adam's voice, Ronan turned. There was a brief moment where he was looking just at Adam, and Adam wished that he could keep him in it forever. "Just wake up," he thought, but he knew Ronan wouldn't. Ronan's gaze dropped. "Mom?" 45. Depending on where you began the story, it was about the Gray Man. The Gray Man liked kings. He liked official kings, the sorts who had the title and crown and all that. But he also liked unofficial kings, who ruled and led and stewarded without any noble bloodline or proper throne. He liked kings who lived in the past and kings who lived in the future. Kings who had become legends only after their death, and kings who had become legends during their lives, and kings who had become legends without living at all. His favorites were the kings who used their power in the pursuit of learning and peace rather than status and property, who used violence only to create a country that did not have to live by violence. Alfred, the king the Gray Man most idolized, epitomized this, having conquered the squabbling kinglings of Anglo-Saxon England to create a unified country. How acutely the Gray Man admired such a man, even as he found himself a hitman instead of a king. It seemed peculiar that he couldn't quite remember his decision to become a hitman. He remembered the academic portions of his life as a historian back in Boston. The lectures, the papers, the parties, the archives, kings and warriors, honor and war guild. He remembered the green mantles, of course, but everything else was difficult to piece together, hard to discern what was true recollection and what was merely dream. Back then, he'd strung one gray day into another, and it seemed likely that he had lost weeks or months or years to this foggy dissociation. Somewhere in there, someone had breathed the word mercenary. And somewhere in there, someone had given up his identity and become the Gray Man. "What are we expecting to find here?" Mora asked him now. They were in the car together, headed out towards Singer's Falls. The presence of only two parts of L'Aumônier at the grocery store had been gnawing at the Gray Man ever since he had left them, and he'd spent much of the night in a dedicated search for the third and most unpleasant brother. Now, although they'd lost sight of his rental car, they continued on toward the barns. "We are hoping to find nothing," the Gray Man said. "We are expecting, however, to find L'Aumônier rifling through Neil Lynch's closets." The part of the Gray Man who used to be a hitman was not thrilled by the idea of Mora insisting on coming with him. The part of him that was very in love with her was deeply satisfied. "Still no answer from Ronan," Mora said, peering at the Gray Man's phone. Blue had told them that morning that Ronan Lynch and Adam Parrish were working at the barns.
Possibly he wouldn't pick up my number, the gray man demurred. Also, possibly he was dead. Le Monnier could be very difficult when cornered. Possibly, Mora echoed with a frown. They found the barns looking idyllic as usual, with only two cars in the gravel area, the Lynch BMW and the parish tricolor jalopy. There was no sign of Le Monnier's rental, but that didn't mean he hadn't parked nearby and walked in. "Don't tell me to stay in the car," Mora said. "I wouldn't dream of it," he replied, opening the door slowly to avoid jamming it into a plum tree still growing barely hidden fruit. "A parked car is a vulnerable place." He retrieved his gun, and Mora put his phone in her back pocket, and they tried the front door. Unlocked. It took them very little time to discover Adam and Ronan in the living room. They were not dead, but they were not quite alive, either. Ronan Lynch was unresponsive on the faded leather couch, and Adam Parrish was keeled back beside the fireplace. A young girl sat bolt upright in front of a dog bowl, unblinking. She had hooves. None of the room's occupants responded to Mora's voice. The gray man found himself strangely affected by the sight of them in such a state, which seemed contradictory given that he had killed Ronan's father. But it was precisely because he had killed Neil that he now felt responsibility and guilt howling in the corridors of his heart. He was his own man now, and in his position as someone else's tool, he had left Ronan in the barns without a protector. "Is this magic or poison?" the gray man asked Mora. "Le Monnier loves his poisons." Mora leaned over the scrying bowl before flinching back from it. "I think it's magic. Not that I'm any good at whatever kind of magic they've been playing with." "Should we shake them?" he asked. "Adam, Adam, come back." She touched his face. "I don't want to wake Ronan in case he's keeping Adam's soul close by. I guess I will go in and get Adam. Hold my hand. Don't let me go for more than, I don't know, 90 seconds. "Is it dangerous?" "It's how Persephone died. The body can't live with the soul too far away. I don't intend on wandering. If he's not close, I'll come back." The gray man trusted Mora to know her own limits, as he assumed she trusted him. He placed his gun on the floor beside his foot, out of easy reach of the girl, if that's what she was, and took Mora's hand. She leaned into the scrying bowl, and as her eyes went blank, he began to count. 1, 2, 3. Adam gasped and twitched. One hand flailed out, grabbing for a handhold that wasn't there, nails scratching against the plaster in a thin attack. His gaze swam onto the gray man with obvious effort. "Wake him," he said in a slurred voice. "Don't let him stay there by himself." The hooved girl leapt up from her position without any sluggishness. Maybe, the gray man thought in retrospect, she'd actually not been scrying at all, and had instead remained perfectly still only as camouflage when Mora and the gray man came into the house, a chilling but perfectly plausible thought. She threw her arms around Ronan where he sprawled, then began to agitate at him, hands pressed flat against his cheeks, pounding his chest, speaking all the while in something that sounded like Latin but was not. Then a peculiar thing happened. In principle, the gray man knew what was happening, but it was a very different thing to see it actually occur before one's eyes. Ronan Lynch brought something back from his dreams. In this case, blood. In one moment he was asleep, and in the next he was awake, and his hands were mired in gore. The gray man's brain moved uneasily between those moments, and he felt that it had neatly removed the most difficult image, the one in the middle. Adam had clambered unsteadily to his feet. "Bring Mora back! You have no idea!" Yes, 90 seconds. It had been 90 seconds. The gray man used Mora's hand to tug her away from the scrying bowl, and because she had only wandered in shallowly, she returned to him at once. "Oh no," she said. "It's awful. It's so awful. The demon. Oh no." She looked at once to Ronan on the couch. He had not moved even a fraction, although his eyebrows had become more intentional over his closed eyes.
there was not a lot of blood on the outside of him in comparison to how much a human generally carried on the inside, but there was nonetheless something fatal-looking about the display. It was the combination of blood and mud, the bits of bone and viscera stuck to the heels of his hands.
"Fuck!" said Adam vehemently. He had begun to shake, though his face had not changed.
"Is Ronan hurt?" Mora asked.
"He doesn't move right after," Adam said. "If he brings something back, give him a second." "Fuck! His mother's dead."
"Look out!"
the girl shouted, and it was that and only that that kept the gray man from dying when L'Aumônier appeared around the corner with a gun. L'Aumônier did not hesitate for even a second when he saw the gray man. To see him in this context was to shoot him. The sound was bigger than the room. The girl let out a shriek that had nothing to do with the sound a human girl would make and everything to do with the sound that a crow would make. The gray man had hit the deck immediately, taking Mora down with him. He found in that bare second on the worn floorboards that he was facing a choice. He could try to disarm this part of L'Aumônier, securing the area and reminding him that now that Greenmantle was dead, L'Aumônier should not have had any quarrel with the gray man. It was not as impossible as it sounded. The gray man had a gun within easy reach of his hand as well, and Adam Parrish had already proven himself extremely cool and resourceful. Such a negotiation would leave the barns open to L'Aumônier's interest, of course, and once L'Aumônier caught sight of the girl with the hooves, that interest would be undying. This part of the world, and along with it 300 Fox Way and Mora and Blue, would forever be open to threat unless they fled as Declan and Matthew Lynch had. If he chose this path, he would have to be constantly vigilant to protect them from the interested parties, constantly on the defensive. Or the gray man could shoot L'Aumônier. It would be a declaration of war. The other two parts of L'Aumônier would not let it pass without remark, but perhaps a war was what this twisted business needed. It had been devolving into a dangerous anarchy of alleyways and basements and kidnappings and hitmen since some time before him, and had only become more unruly. Perhaps what it needed was someone to impose some rules from the top down to get these messy kings in line. But it would not be easy, and it would take years, and there was no version of it that meant that the gray man got to stay with Mora and her family. He'd have to take the danger elsewhere, and he'd have to once again throw himself into that world. He wanted to stay so badly in this place where he had begun to put violence down, in the place where he'd learned how to feel again, in this place that he loved. Only a second had passed. Mora sighed. The gray man shot L'Aumônier. He was a king.
46. It was not at all impossible for Blue to believe that a demon had killed Ronan's mother and was killing Cabeswater too. When they came back from the lunch at the schoolhouse, having received dozens of calls from both Ronan's phone and 300 Fox Way, it felt like the end of the world. Knots of clouds snarled over the town and inside the house where the gray man was packing the few small things that he had left behind there. "You kill the demon," he told them all. "I will do my best to handle the rest. Will I be back someday?" Mora just put her hand on his cheek. He kissed her, hugged Blue, and was gone. Jimmy and Orla, shockingly, were gone as well. They did not deserve to be in the line of fire, Mora said, and had gone to stay with old friends in West Virginia until it was certain what would happen to Henrietta and the psychics in it. Every appointment had been canceled, so there were no clients, and the hotline was set up to send every caller straight to voicemail. Only Mora, Calla, and Gwynthlian remained. It felt like the end of everything. Blue asked Adam, "Where's Ronan?" Adam led Blue and Gansey out of Fox Way into the chilly day, moving carefully to avoid unseating Chainsaw, who perched on his shoulder with her head hung low. Ronan's car was parked on the curb a few houses away. Ronan sat motionless behind the wheel of the BMW,
eyes fixed on some point down the road behind them. A trick of the light played over the passenger seat. No, it was no trick. Noah sat there, barely present, also motionless. He was already slouching, but when he caught a look at Blue's stitches, he slouched down even farther. Blue and Gansey walked to the driver's side and waited. Ronan did not roll down the window or look at him, so Gansey tried the door, found it unlocked, opened it. "Ronan," he said. The gentle way he said it nearly made Blue cry. Ronan did not turn his head. His feet rested on the pedals, his hands rested on the bottom of the steering wheel. His face was quite composed. How miserable it was to imagine that he was the last Lynch left here. Beside Blue, Adam shuddered violently. Blue looped her arm around him. It was terrible to imagine that while Gansey and she had been having lunch, Ronan and Adam had been wandering through a hellscape together. Gansey's gallant magicians both felled by horror. Adam shook again. "Ronan," Gansey said again. In a very low voice, Ronan replied, "I'm waiting for you to tell me what to do, Gansey. Tell me where to go." "We can't undo this," Gansey said. "I can't undo it." This did not make a dent in Ronan's expression. It was terrible to see him without any fire or acid in his eyes. "Come inside," Blue said. Ronan didn't acknowledge this. "I know I can't undo it. I'm not stupid. I want to kill it." A car groaned by them, giving the three of them a wide berth where they stood by Ronan's open door. The neighborhood felt close and present and watching. Inside the car, Noah leaned forward to make eye contact with them. His face was miserable. He touched his own eyebrow where Blue's was scratched. "It wasn't your fault," Blue thought at him. "I'm not upset with you. Please stop hiding from me."
"I'm not going to let it get to Matthew," Ronan said. He took a breath through his mouth, released it through his nostrils. Slow and intentional. Everything was slow and intentional, flattened into a state of tenuous control. "I could feel it in the dream. I could feel what it wanted. It's unmaking everything I've dreamt. I'm not going to let that happen. I'm not going to lose anyone else. You know how to kill it." Gansey said, "I don't know how to find Glendower."
"You do, Gansey," Ronan replied, voice uneven for the first time. "I know you do. And when you're ready to get him, I'll be sitting right here, waiting to go where you tell me."
"Oh, Ronan."
Ronan's eyes were still trained on the road ahead of them. A tear ran down his nose and clung to his chin, but he didn't so much as blink. When Gansey said nothing else, Ronan reached for the door handle without looking, with a thoughtless stretch of familiarity. He tugged the door free of Gansey's hand. It closed with less of a bang than Blue had thought Ronan was capable of. They stood there outside their friend's car, none of them speaking or moving. The breeze shuffled dry leaves down the street in the direction of Ronan's line of sight. Somewhere out there was a monster eating his heart. Blue couldn't think too hard upon the trees of Cabe's Water under attack, or she became too restless to even stand. She said, "Is that the language puzzle box in the back seat? I'm going to need it. I'm going to go talk to Artemis."
"Isn't he in a tree?" Adam asked.
"Yeah," Blue said, "but we've been talking to trees for a while." Only a few minutes later, she picked her way out across the exposed roots of the beech tree to its trunk. Gansey and Adam had joined her, but had been given strict orders to remain on the patio outside the back door and to come no closer. This was going to be about her, her father, and her tree. Hopefully. She could not count how many times she had sat beneath this beech tree. Where others had a favorite sweater or favorite song, a favorite chair or a favorite food, Blue had always had the beech tree in the backyard. It wasn't just this tree, of course. She loved all trees, but this tree had been a constant her entire life. She knew the dips in its bark and how much it grew each year, and even the particular smell of its leaves when they first began to bud in the spring. She knew it as well as she knew anyone else in 300 Fox Way. Now, she sat cross-legged among its torn-up roots with the puzzle box resting on her calves and a notebook resting on top of it. The jostled ground was damp and cold against her thighs. Probably, if she was being really practical, she would have brought something to sit on. Or perhaps it was better to feel the same ground the tree felt. "Artemis," she said, "can you hear me? It's Blue, your daughter." Right after she said this, she thought maybe it had been a mistake. Maybe he would rather not be reminded of that fact. She corrected, "Mora's daughter. I'm sorry in advance for my pronunciation, but they don't really offer books for this." She had first begun to have the idea to use this puzzle box of Ronan's earlier that day while talking to Henry. He had explained to her how the bee translated his thoughts more purely than words did, how the bee was more essentially Henry than anything that actually came out of his mouth. It got her thinking about how the trees of Caveswater had always struggled to communicate with the humans, first in Latin, then in English, and how they had another language that they seemed to speak with each other, the dream language that was featured on this translation box of Ronan's. Artemis didn't seem remotely able to express himself. Maybe this would help. At least it might look like Blue was trying to make an effort. Now she spun the wheel around to translate the things she wanted to say into the dream language and jotted down the words that appeared. She read the written sentences out loud, slowly and without surety. She was aware of Adam and Gansey's presence, but it was comforting, not awkward. She'd done stupider-looking rituals in front of them. Out loud, the sentences sounded a little like Latin. In Blue's head, they meant, "Mom always told me that you were interested in the world, in nature, and the way people interact with it, just like me. I thought maybe we could talk about that in your language." She wanted to ask about the demon straight away, but she'd seen how badly that had gone for Gwynthian, so now she simply waited. The backyard was the same as it had been before. Her hands were clammy. She wasn't entirely sure what she expected to happen. Slowly, she moved the dials on the puzzle box to translate another phrase from English. Touching the smooth, skin-like bark of the beech tree, she asked it out loud, "Please, could you at least tell me if you're listening?" There was not so much as a rustle from the remaining dry leaves. When Blue was much younger, she had spent hours setting up elaborate versions of the psychic rituals she'd seen her family undertaking. She'd read countless books on tarot, watched web videos on palmistry, studied tea leaves, conducted seances in the bathroom in the middle of the night. While her cousins effortlessly spoke to the dead and her mother saw the future, Blue struggled for even a hint of the supernatural. She spent hours straining her ears for an otherworldly voice, trying to predict which tarot card she was about to overturn, waiting to feel something dead touch her hand. This was exactly that. The only thing that was slightly different was that Blue had started this process somewhat optimistic. It had been a very long time since she'd fooled herself into thinking that she herself had any connection with the other world. If she wasn't being bitter about it, it was because she hadn't thought that this was about the other world. "I love this tree," Blue said finally in English. "You don't have any claim to it. If anyone could live inside it, it should be me. I've loved it way longer than you could have." With a sigh, she stood up, brushing muck off the back of her legs. She gave Gansey and Adam a rueful look.
"Wait."
Blue froze. Gansey and Adam both looked sharply behind her.
"Say what you just said."
Artemis's voice emanated from the tree, not like the voice of God, but rather like a voice coming from just behind the trunk. "What?" Blue asked.
"Say what you just said."
I've loved this tree?
Artemis stepped from the tree. It was the same as when Aurora had stepped out of the rock back in Caveswater. There was tree, and then man and tree, and then just man. Artemis held out his hands for the puzzle box, and she put it in them. He sank to the ground with the box in his lap, folding his long limbs around it, turning the dial slowly and looking at each side. Watching his long face and tired mouth and slumped shoulders, Blue was amazed by how differently Artemis and Gwynplaine wore their age. Gwynplaine had been made young and angry by 600 years of marking time. Artemis looked defeated. She wondered if that was from the 600 years in total or only the past 17. She simply said it. You look tired. He peered up at her, small eyes bright in his long face, wrinkles deep set around them.
I am tired.
Blue sat down opposite him. She didn't say anything at all as he continued testing the box. It was strange to be able to identify the origin of her hands in his hands, though his fingers were longer and knobbier.
I am one of the Tira Alentes, Artemis said finally. This is my language.
He turned the dials on the unknown language side to spell Tira Alentes. The translation shifted on the English side, which he showed to her. Tree lights, she read. Because you can hide in trees?
They are our...
He faltered. Then he turned the dials and showed her the box again. Skin. House. You live in trees?
In. With. He considered. I was a tree when Mora and the other two women pulled me out of it years ago.
I don't understand, Blue said. But kindly, she was not uncomfortable because of the truth of him. She was uncomfortable because the truth of him suggested a truth in her. You were a tree? Or you were in a tree? He looked at her, doleful, tired, strange, and then he spread his hand for her. With the fingers of his other hand, he traced the lines in his palm.
These remind me of my roots.
He took her hand and placed it flat on the skin of the beech. His long, knobby fingers entirely eclipsed her small hand.
My roots are yours, too. Do you miss your home?
She closed her eyes. She could feel the familiar, cool bark beneath her skin and felt once again the comfort of being under its branches, on top of its roots, pressed to its trunk.
You loved this tree, Artemis said. You already told me.
She opened her eyes. She nodded.
Sometimes we, Tira Alentes, wear this, he continued, dropping her hand so he could gesture to himself. Then he touched the tree again. Sometimes we wear this.
I wish, Blue said, then stopped. She didn't have to finish the sentence anyway. He nodded once. He said,
here is how it began.
He told the story just as a tree grows, beginning with a seed. Then he dug in fine roots to support it as the main trunk began to stretch upward.
When Wales was young, Artemis told Blue, there were trees. It is no longer all trees, or it wasn't when I left. At first, it was all right. There were more trees than there were Tira Alentes. Some trees cannot hold a Tira Alentes. You know these trees. Even the dullest man knows these trees. They are.
He glanced around. His eyes found the weedy, fast-growing locusts on the other side of the fence and the decorative plum tree in a neighbor's yard.
They do not have a soul of their own, and they aren't built to hold anyone else's.
Blue ran her fingers over an exposed beech root next to her leg. Yes, she knew. Artemis spread more roots for his story.
There were enough trees that could hold us in Wales. But as the years went by, Wales turned from a place of forests to a place of fires and plows and boats and houses.
It became a place for all the things that trees could be, except for alive.
The roots were dug in. He began on the trunk.
The Amaiweas were failing. The Tiralintes can only exist in trees near them. But we feed the Amaiweas, too. We are okay, Etires. Like the sky and the water. Mirrors.
Despite the heat, Blue put her arms around herself, as chilled as she would have been by Noah's presence. Artemis looked wistfully at the beech tree, or at something past it, something older.
A forest of Tiralintes is something indeed. Mirrors, pointed to mirrors, pointed to mirrors. The Amaweas churning up below us, dreams held between us.
Blue asked, what about one of them? What is one of them? He regarded his hands ruefully.
Tired.
He regarded hers.
Other.
And the demon?
But this was skipping ahead. He shook his head, backed up.
Owain was not like common men, he said. He could speak to the birds. He could speak to us. He wanted his country to be a wild place of magic, a place of dreams and songs crossed by powerful Amaiweas. So we fought for him. We all lost everything. He lost everything.
All of his family died, Blue said. I heard. Artemis nodded.
It is dangerous to spill blood on an Amaiwea. Even a little can plant dark things.
Blue's eyes widened. A demon. His eyebrows tipped much further along toward the sad side of things. His face was a portrait called worry.
Wales was unmade. We were unmade. The Tiralintes who were left were to hide Owain Glyndar until a time when he could rise again. We were to hide him for a time, to slow him as we are slow in trees. But there were not enough places of power left on the Welsh, Amaiweas, after the demon's work. And so we fled here. We died here. It is a hard journey.
How did you meet my mother?
She came to the spirit road intending to communicate with trees, and that is what she did.
Blue started, then stopped, then started again.
Am I human?
Mora is human.
He did not say, and so am I. He was not a wizard, a human who could be in trees.
He was something else.
Tell me, Artemis whispered, when you dream, do you dream of the stars?
It was too much. The demon, Ronan's grief, the fact of the trees, to her surprise, a tear welled in her eye and escaped. Another was queued up behind it. Artemis watched it fall from her chin, and then he said,
all of the Tiralintes are full of potential, always moving, always restless, always looking for possibilities to reach out and be somewhere else, be something else. This tree, that tree, that forest, that forest. But more than anything, we love the stars.
He cast his eyes up as if he could see them during the day.
If only we could reach them, maybe we could be them. Any one of them could be our skin house.
Blue sighed. Artemis looked at his own hands again. They always seemed to make him anxious.
This form is not the easiest for us.
I just want to go back to a forest on the spirit road, but the demon unmakes it.
How do we get rid of it?
Very reluctantly, Artemis said.
Someone must willingly die on the corpse road.
Darkness descended so rapidly on Blue's thoughts that she reached to balance herself on the beech tree. She saw Gansey's spirit walking the ley line in her mind.
She remembered abruptly that Adam and Gansey were within earshot. She had completely forgotten that it was not just Artemis and her. "Is there another way?" she asked. Artemis's voice was quieter still.
"Willing death to pay for unwilling death. That's the way."
There was silence, and then more silence. And finally Gansey asked, his voice raised from next to the house, "What about waking Glendower and using that favor?" But Artemis did not reply. She had missed the moment of him going. He was in the tree, and the puzzle box sat askew in the roots. Blue was left holding this terrible truth and nothing else, not even a scrap of heroism. "Please come back," she said, but there was only the stirring of dried leaves overhead. "Well," Adam said, his voice as tired as Artemis's, "that's that." 47. Night fell. That at least could still be relied upon. Adam opened the driver's side door to the BMW. Ronan had not moved a bit since they had seen him last. He was still looking down the road, feet on the pedals, hands resting on the steering wheel, ready to go, waiting for Gansey. It was not grief. It was a safer, more vacant place beyond it. Adam told Ronan, "You can't sleep here." "No," Ronan agreed. Adam stood in the dark street, shivering in the cold, stepping from foot to foot, looking for any evidence that Ronan might budge. It was late. Adam had called Boyd an hour ago to tell him that he would not be getting to the Chevelle with the exhaust leak he'd promised he would look at. Even if he could have forced himself awake, Adam could nearly always accomplish this. He wouldn't have been able to stand working in the garage knowing that Cabe's Water was under attack, Lemonnier was conspiring, and Ronan was mourning. "Are you going to come inside and at least eat something?" "No," Ronan said. He was impossible and terrible. Adam shut the door and lightly pounded his fist 3 times on the roof. Then he went to the other side of the car, opened the door, made sure Noah wasn't in there, and climbed in. As Ronan watched him, he fumbled around with the seat controls until he found the one that made it recline all the way, and then he clawed for Ronan's Aglimby jacket. Both it and the orphan girl were hopelessly balled up among the other things in the back seat. The orphan girl snuffled and pushed the jacket toward his hand. He wadded it beneath his neck as a pillow, draping the sleeve over his eyes to block out the streetlight. "Wake me up if you have to," he said, and closed his eyes. Inside 300 Fox Way, Blue watched Gansey let himself be convinced to stay there instead of returning to Monmouth for the night. Even though there were now plenty of empty beds in the house, he took the couch, accepting just a quilt and a pillow with a light pink pillowcase. His eyes weren't closed by the time she went upstairs and put herself to bed in her own room. Everything felt too quiet inside the house with everyone gone, and too loud outside the house with everything menacing. She did not sleep. She thought of her father becoming one with a tree, and she thought about Gansey sitting in the Camaro with his head ducked, and she thought about the whispered voice of the dark sleeper she'd encountered in the cave. Things felt like they were spooling to the end. "Sleep," she told herself. Gansey slept in a room 12 feet below her. It should not have mattered. It did not matter. But she could not stop thinking of the nearness of him, the impossibility of him, the promise of his death. She was dreaming. It was dark. Her eyes didn't get used to it. Her heart did. There was no light to speak of. It was so completely dark that eyes were unimportant. Now that she thought about it, she wasn't sure she had eyes. This was a strange idea. What did she have? Cool damp at her feet? No, her roots. Stars pressing down above her, so close that they could surely be reachable if only she grew a few more inches. A warm, vital skin of bark. This was the shape of her soul. This was what she had been missing. This was how she felt in her human skin. Tree-shaped feelings in a human body. What a slow, stretching,
joy. Jane, Gansey was there. He must have been there all along, because now that she thought about it, she couldn't stop sensing him there. She was something more. He was still human. He was a king stolen away into this tree by the Tira Alinte that was blue. She was all around him. The joy from her previous revelation overlapped slowly onto this joy. He was still alive. She had him with her. She was as close to him as she could possibly be. Where are we? We're a tree. I'm a tree. You're... I can't say that. It would be filthy. Are you laughing? Yes, because I'm happy. Slowly, her joy tapered, though, as she felt his rapid pulse against her. He was afraid. What are you afraid of? I don't want to die. This felt true, but it was hard to put together thoughts with any speed. This tree was just as ill-fitted to her essential blueness as her human body. She remained half one, half the other. Can you see if Ronan has come in from the car? I can try. I don't really have eyes. She stretched out with all of the senses available to her. They were ever so much better than her human ones, but they were interested in very different things. It was exceptionally difficult to focus on the affairs of the humans around the base of the trunk. She had not properly appreciated how much effort it had taken the trees to attend to their needs before now. I don't know. She held him tightly, loving him and keeping him. We could just stay here. I love you, Blue, but I know what I have to do. I don't want to, but I know what I have to do. 48. All of the sounds and smells of Fox Way were magnified after dark, when all of its human occupants were quiet. All of the fragrant teas and candles and spices became more distinct, each declaring their origin, when in daytime they mingled into something Gansey had only previously identified as Fox Way. Now, it struck him as something both powerful and homey, secret and knowing. This house was a place of magic, same as Cabe's Water, but one had to listen harder for it. Gansey lay on the couch with a quilt over him, his eyes closed against the dark, and listened to the rattle of air or breath through a vent somewhere, to the scratch of leaves or nails against a window somewhere, to the thump of popping wood or footsteps from the other room. He opened his eyes, and there was Noah. This was Noah without any daylight to cloud what he really had become. He was very close, because he had forgotten that the living could not focus on things closer than 3 inches. He was very cold, because he now required massive amounts of energy to remain visible. He was very afraid, and because Gansey was afraid, their thoughts tangled. Gansey kicked off the quilt. He tied on his shoes and put on his jacket. Quietly, taking great care to tread lightly on these old floors, he followed Noah out of the living room. He didn't turn on any lights, because his mind was still tossed together with Noah's, and he was using Noah's eyes, which no longer cared if it was dark or not. The dead boy didn't take him outside as he'd expected, however, but up the stairs to the second floor. For the first half of the stairs, Gansey thought that he was being led on Noah's usual haunt around the house, and for the second, he thought he was being taken to Blue. But Noah passed her door and instead waited at the base of the attic stairs. The attic was a charged location, having been occupied first by Neve and then by Gwentlyn, two people difficult in different ways. Gansey would not have regarded either of them as possible paths forward, but Noah had led him there, and so Gansey hesitated there, with his hand over the knob. He did not want to knock. He would wake the rest of the house. Noah pushed on the door. It fell open lightly. It had not been latched, and Noah proceeded up the stairs. Wan light came from the top of them, accompanied by a biting chill scented with oak. It felt like a window was open. Gansey followed Noah. A window was open.
Gwynplaine had turned the room to witchy clutter, and it was currently full of every strange thing but herself. Her bed was empty. Cold night air came through a round porthole window. By the time Gansey had climbed through it, Noah had vanished.
"Hello, little king,"
Gwynplaine greeted. She was far out on one of the house's small, mismatched roof angles, boots braced against the shingles, a dark and strange silhouette in the ambient and flickering light of the haunted streetlights below. There was nonetheless something noble about her, a brave and arrogant tilt to her chin. She patted the roof beside her. "Is it safe?" She cocked her head.
"Is this how you die?"
He joined her, picking his way carefully, dirt and tree litter crumbling beneath his shoes, and then sat beside her. From this vantage point, there were trees and more trees. The oaks that were merely featureless trunks at ground level were complicated worlds of ascending branches at roof level, the patterns of them made more complex by the shadows thrown by the orange glow below.
"Hi-ho, hi-ho,"
Gwynplaine sang in a low, disdainful voice. "Are you coming to me for wisdom?" Gansey shook his head. "Courage," she appraised him. "You tried to stop your father's war," Gansey said, "by stabbing his poet at the dinner table. You had to be almost certain it wouldn't end well for you. How did you do it?" Her act of bravery had happened hundreds of years before. Glendower had not been fighting on Welsh soil for centuries now, and the man Gwynplaine had tried to kill had been dead for generations. She'd been trying to save a family that now no longer existed. She'd lost everything to sit upon this roof of 300 Fox Way in a different world entirely.
"Haven't you learned yet? A king acts so that others will act. Nothing comes from nothing, comes from nothing. But something makes something."
She drew in the air with her long fingers, but Gansey did not think that she was drawing anything intended for a gaze other than her own.
"I am Gwynplaine Glendower, and I am the daughter of a king and the daughter of a tree light. And I did something so that others would do something. That is kingly."
"But how?" Gansey asked. "How did you manage it?" She pretended to stab him in the ribs. Then when he looked at her ruefully, she laughed wildly and freely. After she had been merry for a full minute, she said,
"I stopped asking how. I just did it. The head is too wise. The heart is all fire."
She did not say anything more. And he did not ask anything more. They sat there beside each other on the roof, she dancing her fingers through the air, he watching the lights of Henrietta dance similarly in time to some hidden and sputtering ley line. Finally he said, "Would you take my hand?" Her fingers stopped moving, and she looked at him cannily, holding his gaze for a long minute, as if daring him to look away or change his mind. He did not. Gwynplaine leaned close, smelling of clove cigarettes and coffee, and much to his great surprise, kissed his cheek.
"Godspeed, King,"
she said, and took his hand. In the end, it was such a simple, small thing. He had felt flashes of it before in his life, the absolute certainty. But the truth was that he'd kept walking away from it. It was a far more terrifying idea to imagine how much control he really had over how his life turned out. Easier to believe that he was a gallant ship tossed by fate than to captain it himself. He would steer it now. And if there were rocks near shore, so be it. "Tell me where Owen Glendower is," he said to the darkness. Crisp and sure, with the same power he had used to command Noah, to command the skeletons in the cave. "Show me where the Raven King is."
49. The night began to wail. The sound came from everywhere. A wild scream, a primal scream, a battle cry. It got louder and louder, and Gansey clambered to his feet, his hands half held over his ears. Gwendolyn shouted something in delight and fervor, but the sound drowned out her voice. It drowned out the rattle of the remaining dry oak leaves in the trees, and it drowned out the sound of Gansey's shoes scuffing on the roof as he minced toward the edge for a better vantage point. The sound drowned out the lights, and the street was plunged into blackness. The scream drowned out everything. And when the sound stopped and the lights returned, a dull white-horned beast stood askance in the middle of the street down below, hooves splayed on the asphalt. Somewhere there was the ordinary world, a world of stoplights and shopping malls, of fluorescent lights at gas stations and light blue carpet in a suburban home. But here, now, there was only the moment before the scream and the moment after. Gansey's ears rang. The creature lifted its head to look at him with brilliant eyes. It was the sort of animal that everyone thought they knew the name of until they saw it, and then the name ran away and left behind only the feeling of seeing it. It was older than anything, more lovely than anything, more terrible than anything. Something winning and frightened sang in Gansey's chest. It was the precise same feeling that had taken him the first time he'd seen Cabe's Water. He realized that he had seen something like this creature before. The herd of white beasts that had stampeded through Cabe's Water. Now that he was looking at this one, though, he realized that those were copies of this, descendants of this, dreamt memories of this. The beast twitched an ear. Then it plunged into the night. Gwendolyn asked Gansey, "Well, aren't you going to follow it?" "Yes." She pointed at the oak branches, and he did not question her. He edged quickly to where a great branch overhung the roof, climbed out onto it, getting a handhold here and there on upright spurs. He slipped down from branch to branch and then jumped the 8 or 9 feet to the ground, feeling the jolt of the landing from the balls of his feet to his teeth. The beast was gone. There was not even time for Gansey to register disappointment, though, because of the birds. They were everywhere. The air dazzled and shimmered with feathers and down. The birds swirled and dove and plummeted around the neighborhood street, the streetlights catching wings, beaks, claws. Most of them were ravens, but there were others, too. Little chickadees, streamlined mourning doves, compact jays. These smaller birds seemed more chaotic than the ravens, though, as if they had gotten caught up in the spirit of the night without understanding the purpose. Some of them let out little squawks or cries, but mostly the sound was wings. The humming, rushing whoosh of frantic flight. Gansey stepped into the yard, and the dense flock immediately rushed up around him. They swirled around him, wings brushing against him, feathers touching his cheek. He couldn't see anything but the birds, every shape and color. His heart was a winged thing itself. He couldn't catch his breath. He was so afraid. "If you can't be unafraid," Henry said, "be afraid and happy." The flock dipped away. They meant to be followed, and they meant to be followed now. They swirled up in a great column over the Camaro. "Make way," they shouted. "Make way for the Raven King." It was loud enough now that lights were beginning to come on in the houses. Gansey climbed into the car and turned the key. "Start, pig, start." It growled to life. Gansey was all things at once, elated, terrified, overcome, satiated. With a squeal of tires, he pursued his king.